gone so early.
The state funeral will be on Friday. Five NATO soldiers have been killed in eastern Afghanistan. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports local officials say the troops hit an improvised landmine.
Officials in Ghazni province, south of the capital, said a Polish patrol hit a roadside bomb. The Taliban claimed responsibility. Poland has nearly 2,500 troops in Afghanistan as part of the American-led NATO coalition. American and international casualties this year are down from last year, but still higher than in 2009 and all previous years of the conflict. Also, U.S. officials announced today that eight Americans will be charged in connection with the death of another soldier. Private Denny Chen was found shot to death in a guard tower in October with what then appeared to be self-inflicted wounds.
And that's NPR's Quill Lawrence. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
On December 31st, WILL will be halfway through the fundraising year. Our goal during the month of December is to raise $500,000. If we work together, we can reach that goal. Every gift can make a difference, and your contribution to WILL is tax-deductible if you contribute by December 31st. Please support the programs you enjoy. Give online at willpledge.org. And thanks.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. From the time that he was a young man, Thomas Jefferson dreamed of an America that would stretch from sea to sea. This was one of those things that set Jefferson apart from the other founding fathers. In less than a century, and in part because of his vision, that dream became a reality. It changed America and its place in the world. In this part of Focus, we will be talking about some of the key figures in the westward expansion. And our guest for the program is Robert Morgan. He's the author of a recently published book, which is titled Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill is the publisher on the book. And the book explores the lives of 10 American legends, among them Davy Crockett, Johnny Appleseed, Sam Houston, Kit Carson, of course, Thomas Jefferson, taking a look at the ways that individual lives can link up and can have a collective impact on history. As we talk this morning with Robert Morgan, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Email is also possible, will-talk@illinois.edu. A little bit more about our guest, Robert Morgan. He's the author of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction, noted most for his novel Gap Creek and also Boone, his biography of Daniel Boone. Both of those were national bestsellers. And in fact, he talked about the book about Daniel Boone with our Celeste Quinn, and you can hear that on our web archive at will.illinois.edu. He's professor at Cornell University, where he's been since 1971. He's also been visiting writer in residence at a number of other universities, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Morgan, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it's very good to be here.
It's a great sweeping story full of larger-than-life kind of characters. I guess that one of the things that I think that's so interesting here is the way that these lives and their experiences of these people really did intersect. And I don't know if that says something about the fact that at the time America really wasn't such a big place that kind of thing was possible. I don't know that you can quite imagine that kind of thing happening today.
Right. The population certainly was smaller, and particularly on the frontier in the West, it seemed that everybody knew everybody. Figures like Daniel Boone and Andrew Jackson just seemed to know everybody of their time, Sam Houston and David Crockett, for that matter. And I decided to tell the story by linking up a series of biographies. Right at the beginning, I quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, who says there is properly no history, only biography.
And this, I gather that to this, in a sense, is kind of a sequel to the book about Daniel Boone, because you wanted to take the story on from there.
Exactly. The story of Boone, of course, is in the 18th century and then early 19th century. Boone went from Pennsylvania to North Carolina to Kentucky, and then at the end of his life all the way to Missouri. And it actually turns out that Kit Carson was related by marriage to Boone, so there's a family connection there, as there is between Thomas Jefferson and Nicholas P. Trist at the end of the story. The man who negotiated the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in Mexico City was the grandson-in-law of Thomas Jefferson.
That's also an interesting fact, and I think I would have said before this that I had at least heard of all of the people except Nicholas Trist, and you, in a sense, it brackets the story, because if we, you know, if we think of Jefferson as in his many contributions to America, certainly one was the one big one would have to be the Louisiana Purchase, which brought in this big chunk of territory into the country. Well, at the end of the book, there's the story of this man, Nicholas Trist, who was grandson by marriage of Jefferson, who was indeed involved in working out this treaty that came after the Mexican-American War, which also brought an enormous amount of territory into the United States.
Exactly. Very few people know about Nicholas Trist. I guess a few historians, particularly historians of diplomatic history, but he did indeed almost miraculously negotiate this Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, purchasing from Mexico everything from Texas to the Pacific for $15 million in 1847-48. That's about a third of the continental United States. Of course, it helps if the Army of the United States under Winfield Scott is occupying Mexico City. That was very persuasive, I suspect.
Yeah, you might argue that, yes, indeed, the Mexicans got $15 million, but they also didn't really have a great deal of choice in the matter.
That's true. In fact, there were people back in the United States demanding more. In fact, the president who had sent Trist there, James K. Polk, told him what to ask for, and Trist basically got it, except for Baja California. But by then, Polk had decided he wanted even more of Mexico, maybe down to Tampico. And a lot of people in Mexico at the time actually wanted to be annexed, all of Mexico annexed by the United States, because of the violence and instability in Mexico at that time.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting in a sense, we're jumping around a bit, but you, as an epilogue to the book, you include the story of John Quincy Adams, who was really actually opposed to the westward expansion. He wasn't opposed to expansion, interestingly enough. He thought we should be expanding to the north, and rather than taking Mexico, he apparently thought we should take Canada.
Yes, he actually was a passionate expansionist. He just didn't want to expand into the Southwest because he was afraid that would expand slavery, that the southern states would add territory there and overbalance the Northeast in Congress. But he was as passionate about expanding as anybody. He wanted all of Canada up to Alaska, really, up to 5440. And he didn't worry a whole lot about the Native Americans and the French and the Hispanic people in the way, but he was passionately also against slavery and afraid that annexing Texas and then so much of the Southwest would simply add to the power of the slaveholding states and Congress.
Yeah, I think the notion here is that while we certainly, with the exception of Thomas Jefferson, the people that you write about here, we don't think of them as being part of the important founding generation, but you seem to be making the argument that really, if you ask who are the people who are very important to America as it is today, that kind of people that you're talking about here in the book, they really are not to discredit the Jefferson and his peers, but that the people we're talking about here in this book, very important to the to the country, and not just in geographic terms, that it is now?
Well, in recent years, we've seen an enormous amount of attention paid to the Founding Fathers, all these biographies of John Adams and Jefferson and Washington and Hamilton, wonderful, wonderful biographies. But I think that many of us, many historians and writers, are now becoming interested in the next generation, in that period of War of 1812 up through the Mexican War, which did, in a geographical sense and a cultural sense and political sense, define us, I think. Remember that at the time of the War of Independence, the United States was just 13 states along the eastern seaboard, though Virginia and North Carolina claimed to extend all the way to the Pacific, as a matter of fact. But it was Jefferson, I think, more than anybody else, looking to the West and dreaming of what he called the Empire for Liberty. Mm-hmm. And Jefferson believed that if the country expanded, if it was big enough, if it included enough of the continent, that slavery would just wither away naturally. We know he owned slaves, though he abhorred slavery. He always denounced it. He never freed most of his slaves. He freed some. But he worried about how you could end this institution, and that was his best idea, that if you expanded the country enough, that slavery would no longer be useful or profitable, and it would just go away somehow as immigrants came in and did the labor.
Yeah. That, I think that's one of the, as I mentioned, hinting at the beginning, one of the things that does indeed separate Jefferson from the other, from his peers and the Founding Fathers, was that it seemed that the others were really wed to the eastern seaboard. But Jefferson was different. He really did have this dream of a greater America, although I don't know if he was thinking about up to the Mississippi or whether he truly was thinking all the way to the Pacific.
He actually had in mind from early on those great harbors on the Pacific. He believed that his great empire for liberty needed ports on the Pacific, and he actually says in an early letter that the Spanish are good caretakers until we get there. It's fairly early, so he had in mind, you know, as much of the continent. He certainly thought Cuba would be a part of the United States and Canada also. It was a hemispheric vision of the United States, and unlike I think most of the Founding Fathers, he didn't think the United States would necessarily be an Anglophone culture. He liked the idea of a lot of French people or Spanish-speaking people, Native Americans, immigrants from Germany, immigrants from Ireland. I think that's another thing that set him apart from the other Founding Fathers, that he saw a different kind of republic, a very diverse country.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also had this notion, at least I have the idea that he had this notion that the bedrock institution of the country was the yeoman farmer. He must also have thought that if all of these people were going to flow into the country and everybody was going to have their piece of land, we were going to have an awful lot of land.
Exactly. It was an agrarian vision of the republic. He thought cities bred crime, disease, sin, pollution, and that the country he had in mind would be a world of farms, of people who owned their own land and who manufactured things. He was very interested in manufacturing, but sort of in their local factories, their private factories across the country. Of course, at Monticello, we had all kinds of factories making nails and other things. He saw that as a sort of model of what the country could be, would be. That agrarian vision obtained, I think, with a lot of the leaders following him, really until about the time of James K. Polk. Polk may be the last president who primarily saw America as an agrarian society.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Robert Morgan. He's an historian, also writes poetry and fiction, is the author of the novel Gap Creek, a biography of Daniel Boone, which is titled Boone, and the new book, his newest book, one we're talking about here this morning. The title of the book is Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion, and profiles a number of brief linked biographies of a series of individuals that are very important in the westward expansion. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here in Champaign County. We'll talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm trying to remember if it was Adams or Jefferson that had the line about Cuba, about how it was a ripe fruit that was going to fall into our hands. Is that one that you're familiar with?
Yes, I think it was actually maybe John Quincy Adams. It was a pretty common assumption at that time that Cuba just had to be a part of the United States, so it could be any number of people. It was very common to assume that Cuba would be added to the United States, and of course Canada also.
That was de facto part of the United States for a while, and Puerto Rico still has a nebulous category, but that's not really what you're talking about. I was thinking about asking about Jackson, but that's not the Western expansion. That's the abrogation of the Supreme Court ruling about the native tribes down there who were the so-called civilized tribes and still had to go. But you mentioned Guadalupe Hidalgo, and the language that I've heard to describe it is that it also included a clause that allowed for free borders, basically allowing it would be a porous border, so that the people that were on one side of it would be able to visit the people that were in the other side of the purchase, basically, and that's an interesting footnote to the whole militarization of the border that we have now. And I know there's some people that dispute the language and think that it was...
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's true, that there is a clause saying that the people who own land in Nuevo Mexico, New Mexico, or what became, you know, Arizona and Southern California, could sell their land, they could return to it. It was assumed that relations between the two republics would be very friendly. And the two Californias, Baja and Alta California, you know, sort of a part of the same world. I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, it wasn't so much property rights. I thought it was just the idea of, a porous border, basically. Mm-hmm. The idea that this change of status was not going to stop people from visiting their relatives or visiting period, I guess. And
there's a reason that was important in the memory of the people talking, because when the Spanish owned New Spain, which was Mexico, they officially closed the borders. You could not enter Mexico. I mean, people did, of course, and Stephen Austin and his people actually bought land, were allowed to, but it wasn't until Mexico became independent in 1821 that they opened the borders so that people from the United States could come in and trade. That was something, I'm sure, on the minds of the people who were negotiating the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo.
This, certainly you do not avoid the point that this expansion was accomplished with conflict, or that one might say also this expansion was not accomplished without conflict with indigenous people and with Mexico. And in fact, you said that you really wanted to try to understand how the westward expansion, how that looked from the perspective of Mexico, and that you actually invested quite a bit of time doing research on Mexican history so that you could try to get an understanding of what the story looked like from the Mexican side.
I spent about a year studying Mexican history, mostly written by Mexican historians. I wanted to see how they told the story. often, somewhat differently from the way people in the United States have heard this story, but not always. Sometimes their version pretty much coincides. In case of the Mexican War itself, Mexicans claim to have won some of the battles that the United States historians claim were victories. Battle of Buena Vista, the best example, they call it La Angostura, and they're certain that Santa Anna won that battle, though he marched away and left the Americans holding the field. But that was one of the most exciting things for me, and it was one of the areas where I learned the most reading Mexican historians telling their story. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus, again, is historian Robert Morgan, and we're talking about what you will find in his new book, Lions of the West. It is just recently published. Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill is the publisher. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, the caller raised the name of Andrew Jackson, and he is another one of these people that you profile in the book. And I think what's really striking about Jackson is that when with him, we enter into a new era at the president of the presidency, at least in the respect that he was a very different man from those who had come before him. You know, he was the first president not to be one of the Eastern aristocracy men like Jefferson. And he is also somebody who I think for a long time was viewed quite negatively, particularly for his support of slavery and his treatment of Native Americans. Having said that, though, he seems now to be enjoying something of a reassessment, trying to get a little bit more balance, perhaps, in how we look at him. What are your thoughts about Andrew Jackson?
Well, the subtitle of the book is Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion, and people have asked me, who are the heroes and who are the villains? In the case of Andrew Jackson, I have to say he's both. He, in his own lifetime, was possibly the most popular leader and popular president we've ever had. I can't think of anybody who enjoyed longer and really more popularity than he did, thanks to his great victories at Horseshoe Bend and New Orleans in 1815. He was a man of great charisma, could charm people. He was big-hearted. He was generous. He was kind to women and children and to the people who worked for him. But when somebody went against him, stood in his way, he could be brutal. He could be cruel. And the two things held against him, I suspect, in our time are the way he treated the Creek allies. I mean, not his enemies, but his allies after the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. He took their land. He didn't just take land from the Red Stick Creeks. And, of course, he started the removal of the so-called civilized nations, Choctaws and Cherokees, etc., ending after his administration in the Trail of Tears, this terrible, terrible migration all the way out to Oklahoma from Tennessee and North Carolina and Georgia. That it's true, it was after his administration. It was a bungled operation. Van Buren, I guess, was the president then, but he's certainly blamed for that. People who knew him well were so devoted to him. Nicholas Trist, who served as his private secretary in the White House for a while, said President Jackson had more of a woman's nature than any man I ever knew. Isn't that an odd thing to hear about this, great victor, against the Indians? And I think all of this is true. He did not hate Indians. He actually liked Indians. He adopted two Indian boys to raise as his own sons. The man he defeated in the Creek War, Red Eagle, became William Weatherford, a friend who visited him at the Hermitage and trained racehorses for Andrew Jackson. And yet we cannot deny that he could be very cruel, brutal to somebody who stood in his way.
I did earlier, and just as you were talking about the War of 1812, I guess I was also reminded of how I think there are historians that would say that in as much as we think of the Civil War and the Revolutionary War as being wars that really shape the character of the country, that in many ways the War of 1812 was as important, maybe more important.
The War of 1812 is much more important, I think, than most people realize. For one thing, it was the second war with Britain, and this was the British Empire at the height of its power. It had defeated, or was defeating, Napoleon, in this great war in Europe. British historians and other historians are often amazed that Americans consider that they won the War of 1812. And there are reasons that Americans feel they won that war, even though they gained no territory and gained no concessions that they had declared war for. The main reason Americans feel they won the war is they didn't lose it. They were taking on this great empire, and by the end of it, they were still an independent nation, and they had survived.
The people, basically the people here that we're talking about, that you profile in the book, we've got presidents, we've got generals, we've got explorers, we've got mountain men, we've got all those kinds of iconic sort of American figures. And we have all these people that, as you suggest with the subtitle in the book, you have to view as something of a balance of positive and negative qualities, and yet there's one person in here who you say purely, if a lot of these other guys are mixtures of sinner and saint, there's one guy here that's just the pure saint, and that is John Chapman, who is, I'm sure, would be better known to people as Johnny Appleseed. And when you say that, I expect that there are probably a lot of people who say, I thought Johnny Appleseed was a myth. You mean that there actually was a real guy? And the answer is yes, there actually was a real guy.
Oh, I had to include Johnny Appleseed in this book because that's a different kind of westward expansion. He was truly a real person. He was born in Leominster, Massachusetts in 1774. He grew up during the Revolution and afterward. His father fought in the Revolution. Family moved to western Pennsylvania. As a young man, he moved across the river into the Ohio Territory, planting apple trees from seeds and herbs also. He was into herbs as well as apples. He planted apple seeds because he thought that grafting trees was cruel, cutting trees was cruel. He didn't want to do that, even though he knew that you got only one out of six true apples from a seed. But that was enough on the frontier. He was planting these trees so they would be there when the settlers came. He was preceding the settlers into the wilderness. He was very friendly with Indians. He wouldn't kill rattlesnakes or mosquitoes. I suppose the Indians thought of him as a kind of holy fool. He lived out in the forest, sort of with the animals. Many of the legends about him are true. He did go barefoot in winter, and he in the middle of his career became a missionary. I don't think this is very well known. I don't think Walt Disney emphasized this in his film on Johnny Appleseed. He became imbued with enthusiasm for Swedenborgian mysticism. And spent everything he had buying books, translations of Swedenborg's writings, and distributing them among the pioneers out on the Ohio and Indiana frontier, and would preach to anybody who would listen this mystical doctrine that we are already in heaven, in the divine world, if we could just see it, and the dead are not dead, there are angels around us, that kind of thing. We don't think he had many takers among the pioneers. They were more taken with revival preaching hellfire and damnation stuff. But there are wonderful stories from the pioneers who remembered him and talked to writers later about him, the kind of ideas, the way he dressed, the way he acted. Yes, I see him as the saint. He's not a villain.
Yeah, and what is it fair, do you think, to say that he was part of a tradition of thinking about human beings and their relationship to nature that we would say eventually becomes what we now call environmentalism?
I believe that's so. Also, the tradition in American literature we call transcendentalism.
Mm-hmm.
Nature is the language of God. This idea from Swedenborg and others that the natural world is also the divine world, if you can just see it. And how do you know the mind of God? How do you read, the language, the thoughts of God? You look at the Adirondacks, you look at the great rivers, you look at the grass, as Whitman would say, and see the mind, the workings of God. And I believe that Johnny Appleseed represents a very important element in American culture and in the American imagination of not only that mystical vision of nature, but of individual freedom, what Walt Whitman calls the open road, that, you can live your life on your terms, as Thoreau would say.
Yeah.
He's a predecessor of that. Simplicity. You live out with things. You're practical in the way you survive, but you are living in harmony with nature, with the animals, with the Native Americans. He got along very well with the Indians, with the Native Americans. And, of course, I link him in that chapter on him with Thoreau and quote Thoreau a number of times about apples from the great essay called Wild Apples. Also Thoreau's ideas about the glories of solitude, particularly solitude in the wilderness.
Yeah, just though to bring it back to earth, I guess I do understand that the settlers, when they came to the places where he had been and saw those apples, they weren't thinking about making apple pie.
They were making hard cider and applejack.
They were thinking about alcoholic beverages.
And Johnny Appleseed would partake of that also. He was a vegetarian, but he liked applejack.
All right. We're at a point here. We need to pause for just a moment. We'll talk some more with our guest, Robert Morgan. After a short break, this is Focus.
Programs on WILL are made possible by the Illinois Professional Science Master's programs on the Urbana-Champaign campus, offering graduate degrees that combine science and business, including the program in agricultural production. More information is available at 217-265-5363 or on the web at psm.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with different topics every week. In the second hour of the program today, the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk about some of the challenges facing the U.S. Postal Service and how it might change and perhaps why it's important that certain things about it don't change. And our guest will be Nancy Pindus. She is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and has been involved in doing some research on the social value of the postal services. We'll talk about that in the second hour today. You can check the schedule, listen to past programs by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Robert Morgan. He is the author of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. He is the author of the novel Gap Creek and the biography Boone, which is about Daniel Boone. Both of those books were national bestsellers. He's a professor at Cornell University, has been since 1971, has been a visiting writer in residence at a number of universities, and is also author of the new book titled Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Is the publisher. Questions are welcome. We'll get back here to a caller, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And we have someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Morgan.
Good morning.
I want to thank you for your biographies of Daniel Boone and David, not Davy, Crockett.
Right.
the Boone biography inspired me and my wife to visit the so-called Boone House at Defiance, Missouri, twice. And I just hadn't realized that he was a contemporary of the Founding Fathers. So his story is the story of the Western frontier at the time of the American Revolution.
It is.
And I want to thank you for adding that dimension to my understanding of the early history of the United States. And regarding the David Crockett biography, I'm 65. You must be about my age.
Because I
remember the
Walt
Disney movie about Davy Crockett, the King of the Wild Frontier, vividly.
Uh-huh.
And you could have subtitled your book, The Things Walt Disney Never Wanted You to Know About David Crockett.
Uh-huh.
Killed
a bar when he was only three,
yeah.
The song says.
But the other part was his second marriage, and he owned slaves.
I didn't know that he owned slaves.
I thought that was in there.
I don't believe so.
Okay. I thought I read that he had sold a Negro slave girl or something like that.
Well, your memory may be better than mine.
Okay.
I think that's one of the things that separated him from the Jacksonians. They were mostly slave owners, and
yeah.
He was a man of the frontier. It's possible, but I don't remember in any instance of where he owned slaves.
Okay, you're the author, so I will defer to you. In your reading of the biographies of all these famous people of I would call the pre-Civil War period, you could almost put together what I would call a book on the whiskey factor. in this part of American history, because it seemed to be around. You and other authors have commented on its effect and mostly ill effects of on the Americans of the period. Not only you, but I would say Lee Shenlin when he wrote Wicked River, which I would recommend to one and all in the period. And of course, the whiskey factor in the gigantic inauguration riot in Washington when Andrew Jackson finally got to the White House.
Right.
So I look forward to reading your more recent book, and thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, just to talk a little bit more about Mr. Crockett, I think it may be another way in which he is representative of America is the sense in which he created and almost played a character, Davy Crockett, the frontiersman with the coonskin cap. I mean, that was an identity he really cultivated.
He did. He would campaign in his coonskin cap and buckskin jacket and try to appear as the backwoodsman. He was, of course, much more sophisticated than the persona created. And when that play that sort of satirized him came out in 1831 and was presented in Washington, he seemed and stood up to take his bows, actually. Colonel Nimrod Wildfire was the character who could run faster, jump higher, dive deeper, and come up drier, he bragged.
And that play is Lion of the West, and that's where you get your title from.
That's right, by James Kirk Paulding. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another caller here. Let's talk with someone else in her, Ben, on line number two. Hello.
Hello. It seems to me your appraisal of Jackson is somewhat superficial. His domestic policy and his regime in general, particularly the Eaton affair, the destruction of the National Bank, I think it's generally acknowledged, led to the collapse of 1836 and the depression, which drug on for a couple of decades thereafter. Also, the marginalizing of Calhoun seems to me very unfortunate. Here was a man who seemed to have great potential and Jackson and Van Buren's marginalizing of him pushed him far to the right and I think had disastrous results.
Well, the great bone of contention, I think, between Calhoun and Jackson was over the nullification.
Yes.
Calhoun really wanted to secede or just say the Constitution, you know, if a state did not agree with the Constitution, they had a right to ignore the law. And Jackson, well, who was a passionate believer in the Union, you know, said, I will come down to South Carolina and hang the first man for the first tree who tries to nullify the Constitution.
Yes, but that wasn't Calhoun's position initially. That was after he came under the influence of Taylor. And it seems to me that he was pushed into that camp very largely by Van Buren's campaign to marginalize him, and that it was after that that he became an extremist.
Oh, uh-huh. No, I didn't know that.
Well, I think that's very important.
Yeah, thank
at least that is Hofstadter's treatment of the issue.
Uh-huh. No, I think you know more about Calhoun's career than I do.
Well, Calhoun initially seemed to be a very able, very man of great potential, but he certainly came into that nullification camp and, I think, disastrous subsequently. Although at that, he did manage to hold the extremists in check as long as he lived. And in a sense, preserved the Union for a time. It was after his death that the secessionists came to power in the South.
Uh-huh. He was a very bright man. I know that. He's a very good lawyer. A very fine legal mind.
And I agree that he his overall influence was detrimental, and certainly we seem to be coming back to this nullificationist camp with the Tea Party people today. We might perhaps pay more attention to that.
Well, I think the thing that we probably are most critical of about Calhoun is his defense of slavery and his celebration of really the glories of slavery.
Oh, yes. You're right.
He believed that slavery was just exactly, you know, the way things should be. And he embarrassed some of his colleagues for his passionate defense and recommendation of slavery.
Well, he drifted farther and farther to the right as his career progressed, and he became more and more bitter, I think.
That's true. He became rivals with most of the leaders of his time, and people like Houston just absolutely loathed him. He had given Houston that dressing down for coming to the White House dressed as an Indian or wearing his Indian. Of course, Houston was a member of the Cherokee Nation and sort of had a right to dress like an Indian, but I think Houston never forgave John C. Calhoun for that dressing down.
Yeah.
I guess Calhoun was the Secretary of War at that time.
I want to thank the caller. I need to jump in here where we're coming down to the last maybe 7 or 8 minutes of the program. I also want to introduce the guest. Anybody might have just tuned in. We're talking with Robert Morgan. He is writes history, also poetry fiction. His new book is Lions of the West, the subtitle Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. And it's a book that profiles a number of individuals that were important in the expansion into the West. We have talked about some of them. They include Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Davy Crockett, Johnny Appleseed, also Sam Houston, Kit Carson. And if you want to read the book, it's out now. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And we certainly have time for a few other calls if somebody wants to call in. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to go back to Mr. Crockett. I think that maybe there are some people, maybe this is a bit unfair, but I think that there are some people might say that the most significant thing that he did was to die and do it at the Alamo, and that his story and the story of what happened there really galvanized people around the world, caused people to rally around the cause of Texas independence, and that, in fact, ultimately that was one of the things that really changed this country and established its place in the world.
I guess I would have to agree with that. As a congressman, Crockett worked so hard to make land available, cheap land, available to poor people. He never was able to succeed at that when he was in Congress. But his death at the Alamo brought the attention of the United States and really the rest of the world to the issue of Texas independence. Of course, it's in the context of the extraordinary brutality of Santa Anna in Texas. He killed everybody there at the Alamo. He killed hundreds of soldiers at Goliad a little bit later, and at least several score at Refugio. But Crockett was famous, probably world famous, and his death made him a martyr and made so many people sympathetic to the issue of Texas independence. So that, speaking in terms of his historical influence, that may be the greatest thing he ever did. Mm. Sad as it is to say it.
We're coming near to the end of our conversation. We have just touched, at least we've just touched a little bit on those people we have talked about, and there are some people that we haven't, they include Sam Houston, Winfield Scott, Kit Carson, and those are certainly people who, for Westerners, I think, loom much larger in their sense of who they are than perhaps people here in the Midwest or people on the East Coast. Maybe you can just say a little bit about particularly the people who were the explorers, the ones that really had the charge to go out there, and when the United States, when the country acquired all this territory, somebody had to be the person who went out there to look and see what was there and report back.
Well, I think the most important of the mountain men, the so-called mountain men, was Kit Carson. Born in 1809 in Kentucky and grew up in Missouri. Age of 16, he ran away to Santa Fe and then Taos, became a trapper and a scout and an interpreter. He knew Spanish, he knew French, Canadian French, he knew many Indian languages. He never learned to read or write, but he had a photographic mind. He could remember everything he'd ever heard and any piece of ground. My favorite quote from this period is from 1842, John Charles Fremont has been commissioned to map the Oregon Trail, to write a description of the Oregon Trail. He's on a steamboat going up the Missouri. He meets Kit Carson, whom he doesn't know. And he says, I'm looking for somebody to guide me to the Rocky Mountains. And Carson, who was a very modest man, even after he became very, very famous, said, well, I spent some time in the mountains. I think I can take you wherever you want to go. And could he ever? He knew the Rockies from one end to the other. He knew the Great Basin. He knew the Sierras. He knew the Valley of California. Fremont became known as the Pathfinder because of his publications and his maps. But we know who the real Pathfinder was. It was Kit Carson. And other mountain men like Thomas Broken Hand Fitzpatrick. But these trappers, explorers, working in the 1820s up in the 1830s, went all over the Rocky Mountains, the Great Basin, even into the Sierras and as far as the Cascades. One of the great surprises to me in my research was Kit Carson, to discover that he was a small man physically among big Scotch-Irish men, mostly, and that he never learned to read or write. He had to dictate letters and have people read letters to him, though he became a colonel in the American Army, the U.S. Army. And he also did things we were ashamed of, and I think he was ashamed of, such as rounding up the Navajos in 1862 to send to Bosque Redondo Reservation. He later actually went to Washington and got them moved back to Canyon de Chelly and their land. But he's the only person in history that I know of who ever defeated the Navajos. And they have not forgotten that, by the way, the Diné people. I have a graduate student at Cornell who's Navajo, and She does not remember Kit Carson kindly. Mm.
Where, you know, it's a great story, and has the sweep and the grander and the larger than life characters that we like. And at the same time, though, for people who just maybe have a little bit of reservation about the about what's been criticized as being the great man approach to history, I guess we certainly do have to acknowledge, and you would, I'm sure, were it not for a lot of people whose names we don't know, the Western expansion wouldn't have been accomplished, and that in fact, you might say that in a way that that people went west, and then the leaders followed.
I do say that in the introduction. In fact, I concede the paradox of my book, that while I chose these 10 people to write about, 9 of them famous, 1 of them not so famous, that the real story of the westward expansion and certainly the settlement is the story of the thousands of nameless people who went into Indian territory, who fought, who cleared land, that is history. It's a history that's harder to write because they didn't leave written records for the most part, so we have to construe it. I call what I'm doing history by synecdoche. That is, you take representative figures, you take a part of the whole to imply the whole. But I concede that paradox actually in the introduction to the book.
Yeah, and you also talk about that this is a story that, and we certainly have given you have given examples. This is a story that has both tragic and poetic elements. How do you think about each of those things, and about how whether it's possible to balance those things against one another?
Well, I think that's what the historian, the storyteller, has to do. Really, is to try to see it as whole as possible. Of course, you can't really see it whole. Everything is from a biased point of view or a limited point of view. But to tell as much of the story as you know, as you can, good things and bad things. I believe at this particular point, you know, in our history, that many of us are a little confused about what the United States is really about. How did we get here? What do we mean? What do we want? And it helps to study our history and to see some of these paradoxes and to see the nuance. History, not just the simple history we may have been taught in the fifth grade or even in the 11th grade, but this much more complex history that includes the Native Americans, includes the Hispanic people, includes the explorers, as well as the famous founding fathers and the things that happened in the Anglophone world in the East.
Well, there we'll have to leave it as we come to the end of this hour. And if you would like to read the story that we have been sketching out here, and there's certainly much, much more here that we have not talked about, the book to look for is Lions of the West, subtitle Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill is the publisher. It's recently come out. And the author is our guest, Robert Morgan. He teaches at Cornell in Ithaca, has been there since 1971. He's the author of the novel Gap Creek. You also might like to look at his biography of Daniel Boone, and the title of that book is Boone. And Robert Morgan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Support comes from Wesley United Methodist Church on the corner of Green and Goodwin in Urbana, serving all people on the campus and community this season. This Saturday, the Christmas Eve family service is at 4 p.m., and the communion service at 7, and the Christmas Day service is at 10:30 a.m. Details at wesleyui.org.
Coming up in the next part of Focus, we'll be talking about the Postal Service and some of the challenges that it faces. As no doubt that you have heard, the Postal Service says if they're not allowed to make some really big changes, they could be facing bankruptcy in the not-too-distant future. We will talk in the next hour with Nancy Pindus. She's a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. And in part, we'll be talking about the social value of the Postal Service. What does it do, maybe above and beyond carrying letters? We'll do that just a bit. First, though, we'll take a break for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. We're at mid-session. We're seeing a little bit of a change in the market. It was a little bit softer today on ideas of end-of-the-year profit-taking, as well as maybe a little bit better forecast for South America and particularly Brazil and Argentina in their corn-growing areas. But in the recent moments, we're rallying to the positive side of the marketplace. We'll have to see in the noon update what the fundamental changes might have been. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. In Kansas City, March wheat 670 and a quarter, up 2 and a quarter. July, 686 and three quarters, up 3. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 613 and a quarter, up 5 and a half. July, 647 and three quarters, up 4. March corn, 610 and a quarter, up 3 and a quarter. May, 618 and three quarters, up 3. July, 625 and three quarters, up 3.